Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your homes.
Live from the Forbidden Book Group Studio in Doppeltown, USA, it's Necronomapod with your host, Mike Stoffel and Mike Marcotta, episode 118, Peter Watts's The Things. The story of a thing. And nobody loved him. And now,
well, let's make this short.
Yes. The end.
The end.
What's the cocktail?
Okay. So we're finishing up our trilogy of Peter Watts' works.
Yes.
With a short story that got him quite a bit of acclaim.
Yes. This one was much more, this short story was much more accessible.
Accessible, yeah. Yes. It is. But it's actually, it is kind of like a part of, it's kind of a continuous with the other two books that we read by him, with this idea of exploring alternate ways of being alive.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah,
that's his through line.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, you kind of imagine that this story, The Things, is sort of seeing it as taking the point of view of that weird alien that the people are encountering in Blindsight and Acropraxia.
Right.
How
the Portia.
The Portia creature, whatever it is. But so, this story, The Things, won a bunch of awards. It's available online in various audio versions, and it's for free, it's a Creative Commons licensed story out there. So I don't know if our listeners generally have read everything that we have.
We assume so.
But in this particular case, if you got 50 minutes or so, you can actually read this one down before listening to our discussion of it, and we'll wait. Okay.
I recommend going to YouTube and getting the version by Adam Nicol, N-I-C-O-L.
Yeah.
And he reads. He has a lovely British accent.
Nice. Yeah. There was another version that I listened to a little bit of. With a guy with a kind of a American accent. And there's also one that was put out by Clark's World magazine, which originally published the story. That's where it first came out in 2010. The narrator for that podcast of that magazine is a woman. And it works because, you know, this is a non-gendered creature. We encourage you, especially in this case, to give it a listen before... or listening to us just babble about it for a while. All right.
A very short while.
Yeah, a very short while. So the story is specifically a retelling of The Thing by John Carpenter, which, I don't know if you know this, but John Carpenter's The Thing is a remake of another movie by...
Karen Carpenter.
Howard Hawks. Oh. Howard Hawks from like 1958, 57 or something like that, called The Thing from Another World.
Oh.
Which stars James Arnaz as The Thing.
Mm. And, what does it look like, The Thing?
Like James Arnaz with like plants coming out of him.
Oh, all right.
And that is the original short story that it was based on is called Who Goes There? And it was by... John W. Campbell, who was the editor of Astounding, one of the big science fiction magazines in the 40s to the early 60s. He's more famous as an editor, but he wrote this one perfect story, which is very similar to the John Carpenter movie version.
So I never saw the John Carpenter movie version or any versions of The Thing. I've seen clips.
Yeah, clips.
I just saw one.
Yes.
So can you just give a very, very 1 minute sketch?
Sure. It's about a thing and nobody loves him. Right. No, it's in Antarctica. There is an American base, a research base down there, and they encounter this. They discover that the Norwegian base, which is nearby, has been destroyed, they find a dog that survives from it. At any rate, this dog is actually infected by the thing. It's an alien life form that subsumes and imitates biomass, living things. In the movie version, it eventually takes over and destroys the entire American base. And the movie ends with because nobody can tell who has been turned into the thing, it becomes this kind of a masterpiece of paranoia. And it ends with two of the characters in this, the rest of the base is on fire and they're in a shed with guns pointed at each other, waiting to see what happens.
They're waiting to see if
one of them is going to turn into the thing. They don't trust each other. Oh. Meanwhile,
can you see it turn into a thing?
In the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, can it just stay looking like a human?
It does until it doesn't.
Oh.
If you, for instance, when they give an electric shock in that one scene I showed you with the defibrillator,
yeah,
it turns into the guy's chest turns into a mouth and teeth, and it just bites off the doctor's hands.
Right. Oh, that's what's happening.
Yeah, it has a preservation in the movie version. And the movie ends with this seagull flying away overhead. And you think, oh, shit, maybe something got out no matter what. Anyway.
Okay, awesome.
All right.
So this story begins in the American camp, really.
It does.
And we're hearing the thing talk.
Yeah.
It's experience.
And it's very interesting because I remember listening to this first time when it first came out, and it took me a while to figure out that this was a retelling of that movie, because he's talking about I am being MacReady, I am being Copper, I am being it's actually in the story, it's actually subsumed almost everybody in the camp. Right. Everybody in the camp. Right. They just don't know it yet.
Right.
They don't know that they themselves have been subsumed. The thing has crash landed. It had a ship.
Sounds like it might have crash landed a long time ago.
It crash landed probably in the Pleistocene or earlier, and it's been frozen in the ice. And so the Norwegians must have found it and bought up some of its body. And when it defrosted, it immediately tried to do what it always does, and it tries to have communion, which is it literally physically reaches out and touches other living things to commune with them, to communicate in a very deep and biological way, and take it's kind of like the Borg assimilating cultures in Star Trek.
But it doesn't sound like it takes over the cultures. It sounds like the cultures he's encountered, they sort of have this exchange.
Yeah, they have this exchange.
And nobody's hurt by it.
But they become something else. They become part of the thing. So when he talks about, you know, I have been everywhere, I have seen all these things, but I am here now and I can't get back to myself. So this is this one iteration of this one entity with lots of bodies that can continually touch each other and share knowledge and experience.
Because there's other parts of himself out there.
Out in the exchanged
universe.
Exchanged. Yeah. And so...
Which it has a problem mm-hmm. here because we're singularities.
Mm-hmm.
And then it splits itself off, but it can't reconnect with itself very easily.
Yeah, it can't reconnect with itself out in space.
But it can't even hear, or it's struggling to.
Well, it's struggling to because the things, the humans, are destroying parts of it. It needs, it doesn't say this, but it talks about continually needing more biomass. If it had more biomass, it could understand, it could think better. So it's really that the biomass is what it's processing power. It doesn't have enough
of its own. It needs to borrow mitochondria or something.
Yeah, it needs to be. Yeah, it's so it can think deeper and clearer.
Well, and it says quickly. Like I know I have all these memories, all this knowledge, but I don't have all. All I do is I know that I had it.
I know that,
but I don't have it anymore. Yep. But I know that I had it.
Yep. Which is. You know, so the thing is basically
it's just suffering.
It's suffering. It's isolated. It's very scared, and it's simply trying to live, to survive, and get back to itself.
And it can't figure out. Well, why can't it? This always works. Why isn't it working now? Yes. Why is it?
Yeah. So it gets this. So when it reaches out and attempts communion with must be one of the Norwegians. They attack it. It doesn't understand why. And only about 2/3 of the way through the story does it understand. And you said because we're singularities. That's the horrible thing that it discovers. That's the horror in the story, is that humans and creatures on this planet are singularities. They are not networked.
Right.
In the basic biological way that it is.
It's like he plugged into the internet and can only get on like a bulletin board
for recipes and collecting Hummels.
And that's it. It's like, Jesus, what the?
Exactly. And it knows that there are other bulletin boards out there,
but it can't get to them.
It can't get to them. So his main horror, and this was fantastic, when it discovers when it's been subsuming these the biomasses that have names, like you or Clark or asshole, and it realizes that at the top of our brains, at the top of our spinal columns, there is this large, highly networked mass of nerve fibers, and it discovers that is where our consciousness is. Instead of being networked throughout all of our
bodies. All of creation.
Yeah. And all of creation.
Yeah.
And this is horrifying. It's like, how can they stand to be so isolated and so alone?
Yeah.
And indeed, how can we?
we can't.
So instead of it was at the end of the story, it was going to melt itself back into the ice and wait for another age. For a rescue,
but it changes its mind.
And should we just read this last passage? You want to read it, starting with "I can do so much more than that."
Sure,
go for it.
I can do so much more than that. It won't be easy. They won't understand. Tortured, incomplete, they're not able to understand. Offered the greater whole, they see the loss of the lesser. Offered communion, they see only extinction. I must be careful. I must use this newfound ability to hide. Other things will come here eventually, and it doesn't matter whether they find the living or the dead. What matters is they find something like themselves to take back home. So I will keep up appearances. I will work behind the scenes. I will save them from the inside, or their unimaginable loneliness will never end. These poor savage things will never embrace salvation. I will have to rape it into them.
That last line has actually become pretty famous.
Oh, has it?
Yeah. Because it's such a shocking last line. I will have to rape it into them, rape salvation into them, which is brings up all kinds of echoes of the least flattering religious movements of history.
Or batter my heart, three-person of God.
Exactly, John Donne. The thing talks about rape earlier in the story, when it talks about inside and outside, about how it penetrates the flesh and subsumes them. So that's kind of what it's getting at, I'm thinking there. But rape is such a loaded word, and that's also one of the
Well, it is, because it's giving something to somebody that people don't want. Mm-hmm. It's just deciding.
Yeah, it's just deciding. Yeah. It's deciding to save him.
Yeah. So what's his new, what's its newfound, its newfound power that it can go and do this?
Oh, it just, well, it decides that, it decides that morally, because it has a moral code, and that is communion. You need to join with other life forms, bring them into the greater whole, to save them. And that when it discovers that our planet is apparently the only one it's ever encountered where individual consciousnesses are imprisoned in their separate meat sacks.
Right.
And it finds this absolutely horrifying.
Yeah.
So it's going to save us all.
But he says, I must use this newfound ability to hide.
Oh,
so it means it's not going to transform into other things. It's going to stay inside a body and use that one body.
Yeah, or a number of bodies. So what in the story, in this version of the story, it has infected everybody on the base. So when in the movie version, people get revealed to be the thing.
Right.
It's when his ability to hide breaks down.
Yeah.
He doesn't have enough biomass. So there's that little bit where they do the blood test.
Right.
Depending upon what percentage of the biomass it has been able to subsume, if it's been able to subsume just a little bit of it, it doesn't have enough, there's not enough material there for it to think and plan. But if it's subsumed just a little bit of it, the blood doesn't react. But that one guy who it has subsumed early, all of his blood, all the blood was the thing now. So when they put an electrode into it, it just leaps up out of the out of the petri dish, and then they burn him.
Yeah.
And in the scene in the movie I showed you with the defibrillator, because the guy was dead, they're trying the biomass was inert. It was no longer able to control it. And so when it gives it a shock, it leaps into unconscious life and bites his hands off. And the whole thing with the head and the crabby legs.
Yeah.
But for the most part, everyone else there, it's being able to hide just fine. It's learned how to imitate being a human.
Right.
So that's what it needs to do. It needs to imitate being a human until it's taken back to a population center, and then it can really begin its work.
So, why do you think this story is so effective?
Well, for me, the masterful thing is that it's telling this story from the point of view of the thing, which when you see the movie, you cannot imagine something more alien and horrifying. And he really pulls it off. Peter Watts does.
See, I have nothing to compare. I mean, I'm seeing everything after the fact.
Yeah.
So, I mean, because it seems completely, it seems, completely valid to me. Like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Whatever. I'm trying to imagine what this all looks like, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure if you see something from the other angle where it just seemed like this horrible thing, and you're like, oh, it's telling us. It has its own story.
It has
its
own story.
We never think of it. We never think of these things as having their own story.
I know. And this was, I mean, it was pretty great. It was a really, it was a gutsy way to retell the story. Another thing that I enjoyed very much about it is it reminded me of one of the best sci-fi stories ever written. It's called Nine Lives by Ursula Le Guin.
Mm-hmm.
And, brief little story here. So Nine Lives is about this group of clones that work together, mining, and it's told from the point of view of this person who is sort of watching them, helping them as they do their job, so there's nine of them, and they're all clones of the same person, and a mining accident happens, and eight of the nine die, and so this. The narrator helps this one survivor learn how to become an individual.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very hard because you know, all of us are just we're all just one of a kind, but that one was never, the clone always had eight more of people who perfectly understood, and they didn't have to speak. They just understood each other.
It's just like seven.
Seven.
Wasn't it seven on Voyager?
Oh, seven of nine. Yeah.
Seven of nine. Mm-hmm. Same thing.
Yeah. You know, this has been done in science fiction before. But this is a really, this one's was done pretty well.
Well, you end up having sympathy for it.
You really do. Until that last line, and you're like, right, okay, now wait a minute.
Right.
But you know what? It's to hear it to hear it describe the world that it lives in, where everything is in perfect communion, and you're just flowing in each other, and you're just flowing in and out of yourself. Everybody, there's no disagreement. It's just always discovery, adding to yourself. There's nobody else, and.
It's sort of like a twisted version of Walt Whitman's "Sing the Song of Myself."
Sure,
where everything becomes me and I become everything.
Yeah, that's actually right. I never even thought about that. That's actually exactly right. This is
it's a really twisted version. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and so was. I mean, this is just like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The same thing.
Yes. You know? Yeah,
and although I thought all those stories were a sort of a commentary on communism.
Yeah, well, that's how a lot of them were taken, and they were actually products of the Red Scare era.
Right.
And you know, that's, I'm sure that's part of what the original seed of John W. Campbell's story was, a bit of Lovecraft and a bit of Red Scare.
Well, and Ayn Rand has one too, right? We the Living, isn't that?
That's just anti-individualism. That's.
But it's also they're all this one. The character doesn't have a sense of individualism.
Mm-hmm.
It's a collective, and then
that's right.
At the end, it sort of proclaims me, like,
yeah.
I am me kind of thing. You know, I think that's We the Living.
No, that is We the Living. I read that a couple of years ago. Very quickly and with a great deal of surliness.
So, we're for it until we're against it in the story. Like, yay, you got to survive. Like, oh, no.
What's on the cusp of happening at the end of the story is the same thing that's on the cusp of happening at the end of Echopraxia. Our main character
takes off.
Dan Brooks dies, but his body gets picked up, is reanimated,
and it keeps walking
out to save the world.
Yeah.
So this is a short story, and I'm running out of things to talk about.
Well, but let's do this.
All right.
Well, I think we should talk about the cocktail. I think we should go down to the basement. And then let's just talk about, well, assert what are sort of the common things we notice about Peter Watts.
That's a good plan.
Okay.
So what's this about cocktail you're talking about?
Well, you know, it's cocktail. Yeah, so we are drinking something, and I feel like I feel like you're in me and I'm in you right
yes.
now while I'm drinking it. That's, you are me, I am no, you.
You need to use the Peter Frampton song at the end of this one. Okay. I'm in you.
All right.
Okay. Anyway, so the cocktail, which is quite tasty,
mm-hmm.
is constructed as follows. Get yourself an ice crusher and crush some ice. And then...
Buy a bottle of Aquavit.
Yeah. And then gather together your bottles. So we're going to need some Aquavit. We're going to need some Cynar. We're going to need either a lemon or an orange because we need a garnish. And some dry sherry. So take a shot each of the Aquavit, the Cynar, the dry sherry. Mix it together.
And some bitters.
Oh, yes. And some walnut. Oh, yeah. So mix it together. And then pour it over crushed ice in a tumbler. And then garnish with a twist of lemon or orange peel, and on the top, sprinkle some walnut bitters.
Yes. It's delicious. And it's what are we calling it?
We're calling it the Frozen Communion.
Frozen Communion.
Quite tasty. It's giving me a bit of a headache, though.
That's how you know it's a good cocktail. Exactly. It gives you a headache before you finish drinking it.
Before you finish drinking it, another one the next morning.
Well, that's our drink. All right. Yeah, so let's go down to the basement, shall we?
So musty.
Here we are in the basement.
Hooray!
So we are venturing into a new author, new but old and used up author.
and deceased author who had his day, apparently. We will find out more about him as we read into him. But he has he looks like the kind of guy that writes books about the devil.
He really does.
Really does.
He looks like Aleister Crowley.
He looks like Aleister
Crowley had hair.
Yes. So we're gonna read some books by Ray Russell, who had his day in the '50s and sixties. Apparently he was sort of
the most satanic years of American until now.
And so we're going to start with probably his most famous book called The Case Against Satan.
It's not a suitcase.
It's not a suitcase. No. And it just got this came out in a new edition by Penguin Books, which is kind of how it came to my attention. But he's got a lot of other books. So we're going to read two more of them.
Yeah.
We're going to start with The Case Against Satan.
Case Against Satan.
All right.
All right. I'll grab that and let's head up out of the basement.
Let's.
We're out of the basement. How's that? See how that works?
So magical.
So, Peter Watts. So, what do we know about Peter Watts?
Well, he likes to play on the edges of consciousness and biology, it seems to me. He's really into the theory of the mind.
Right, and what's living? What really is living?
Yeah, what is living? What is thinking? What do you need to do that? Do you need a brain, or can you distribute that? Can you think without being conscious? Can you be intelligent without being conscious?
But I also think he has a pessimistic view of humanity.
I think he does as well.
Humans don't hold up very well.
No.
In his novels. And it kind of reminds me of the book by Philip K. Dick, the I Am Legend.
Yes.
Like, there's a new something coming, and humans are not going to be it.
Yeah, that's Richard Matheson.
Richard Matheson, yes. I'm sorry.
Yeah. But yeah, no, yeah, and humans aren't going to be part of it. Yeah. That we're... we're simply a temporary solution.
We're a problem waiting for a solution.
Yeah, it's a problem.
Basically.
Which is kind of, which I kind of buy into as well.
Yeah. We're a problem waiting for a solution.
Yeah, the earth is alive and we're its cancer.
Yeah. Or we're a virus.
Just the idea of cancer comes up over and over again in all three of these books.
Well, and also sort of the maiming of flesh, the reorganizing, or the flesh is not sacred.
It's not sacred, and it's not stable.
Yeah. And it's chewed up and spit out in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and it's weirdly malleable. I mean, especially in the things, where it describes the various shapes it finds itself being forced into or taking. But even in the post-humans in Echopraxia and Blindsight, where evolution is sort of being left behind and technology is taking over, people are being modified biologically, mechanically, into something else. And those modifications are following sort of Moore's law. They're going faster and faster, where people, they get a mod on their body, and it's almost always already out of date by the time they learn how to use it.
Well, the humans in his stories are not appealing people.
No, well,
not very much.
Not very much. I mean, I would have to say that Siri in Blindsight was the most appealing one, and even that, and that was mostly because he was so diminished.
But for the most part, the people in his stories are not like humans. Really, have not much to offer, is what it feels like to me. Like, there's no higher purpose. There's no other than surviving. Other than,
yeah, I mean, I think that's the biologist in him. He's a marine mammal biologist, Peter Watts is, and he studies biology and evolution and adaptation, and he sees nature red in tooth and claw, and he sees humans as absolutely part of that.
Yep.
No matter what stories they tell themselves.
Right.
So in the end, were you glad to have taken this dip into sci-fi horror?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was too.
It was a challenge.
It was a challenge to me too, and I really appreciate you going into these waters.
Don't make me do it again.
not for the podcast.
Bring me some good old fashioned Satanists from the 50s anytime.
Anytime, and so we will.
So anything else about? There's two things.
Yes.
Did I already say the Nichols?
Yes, you did.
All right, fair enough. But we do want to pay homage to the writer of The Exorcist.
That's right. William Peter Blatty passed away 2 weeks ago as we were recording here, which is funny because I was just thinking about him as I was considering doing these Rhea Russell books. And I clicked on William Peter Blatty, and I looked at it, the first line of his biography, and it had a death date. And I'm like, 2017? There's not much of 2017. When did he die? And it was like that morning.
Oh.
but some morbid fucker had already hopped up on Wikipedia and put his death date in
there. Yeah. So we read The Exorcist, so you can go back in our in our archives and find The Exorcist.
Exactly.
And have a read.
Have a read, yeah. So
he was very formative, I guess, in my own love of horror. It's one of my first books of horror that I ever read. And The Exorcist came out. It was a big phenomenon.
It was, yeah.
When I was a preteen.
Preteen, yeah. I remember seeing that as the only movie that ever made me sleep with a rosary.
Yeah.
Scared the bejeez out of me.
Who didn't think they were possessed at one point or the other after that? Or somebody that we knew.
I totally was.
Made me want to become a priest. No. All right. So that's.
I think that's it, all we have to say about that.
Short and sweet.
Yeah. Ba-dum-ba-dum.
All right. So what should we do with this thing?
I think we should bathe it with fire, melt it back into the ice,
right,
and
just let it sit there
and look for it again.
let somebody else
deal with it in 100,000 years.
Amen.
All right, bye. She gave me the love that I never had.
You're